Dr. Girish Kanji is with me. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Peter.
Thank you for coming in to talk about a topic which I imagine affects hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of New Zealanders, that of depression, anxiety, and the side effects from those conditions. You have a personal connection to it. Can we first start with your story?
Sure,
and
Peter.
And why you have written so much about this, studied so much about it, and tell us how you suffered from it from a very young age.
Sure, Peter. Basically, there was a few hospitalizations when I was young. Firstly, when I was 5, I had tuberculosis and spent 3 months in Chest Hospital in Mount Victoria in Wellington. And it was pretty isolating. I remember my mum would come every day. She'd have to walk up the hill and see me, and she bought some food. And that was really the major contact to the outside world. I've shut it off mostly, and I don't really remember too much else about it. A year later, I was involved in a car accident, and I broke a hip, and I was in traction for 9 weeks. So once again, I was
at the age of what, 6?
About 6.
Wow.
I remember a lot more about that hospitalization, and mainly I remember my family. I've got 6 brothers and sisters, and they'd visit me and would play cards. And I always remember when they'd leave, I'd break down in tears and really sob myself to sleep. And I particularly remember that. And in fact, one day when they came to the hospital, my dad bought a new car. It was a second-hand car, but it was a station wagon. And there were 9 people in the family, and we basically had a 2-seater truck, which obviously didn't accommodate everyone.
A wee bit crammed, yes.
A wee bit crammed. And yeah, once they brought this new car to the hospital, and it was like, wow, there's going to be not quite seats for everyone, but it was a lot better than 2 seats. So soon after I left the hospital, pretty much till I was 40, 3 or 4 times a week I'd have nightmares and night sweats.
So you're talking 35 years?
35 years. They were there. And I remember the main one. There were lots of them, but the main one was walking down Cuba Street in Wellington, where the fountain is, which you may remember.
The bucket fountain?
The bucket fountain.
Yeah.
And as I'd walked down, it was dark. The whole family was with us, and there was a busker with a boiler hat, and he was busking on his guitar, and as we walked past, he'd grab me, and he'd run off with me. And I'd just wake in an almighty sweat, heart pounding.
And how long did this dream go on for?
It went on for years and years. And
during this time you were growing up, you went through puberty, through adolescence, through high school, through medical school, you became a qualified doctor, and you're wondering, what the hell is going on in my mind?
Well, it's a miracle, actually. And someone said this to me recently. I was talking to that. I'm sitting in front of you here today, able to discuss this rationally.
So did you ever consider, because life was so difficult for you, because you kept on having these terrible nightmares, and despite the fact that you were married, you'd become a father, you had 3 children pretty quickly, did you ever think that, I've got to find a way out of this? Did you ever have suicidal thoughts yourself?
Look, I probably have had some thoughts when I was in a really bad place. Luckily, not for long. And I had one episode of major depression when I was just coming home from Otago at medical school. And I was changing from being in Otago for 2 years to coming back to Wellington. And that lasted several months. And I clearly remember that. Before we go on to that, I think I'd like to sort of expand on the childhood trauma thing, because
it had such a long-lasting effect. Is that what you're saying?
It has a long-lasting effect, and I think the relationship between childhood trauma and symptoms people have for life is something I've learned out of the book. And the facts from the study show that if you have one childhood trauma, your risk of depression and suicide doubles. If you have 4, your risk of depression increases fivefold, and your risk of suicide is 12 times the general population.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you got to the age of 40 and you were a doctor, you're a father, a family man. What kind of medicine were you practicing? Were you a general practitioner, or had you become a specialist by this stage, or not?
Initially, when I left med school, I went to the hospital for a few years and did general practice for around a decade.
And the whole time your mental issues, your issues with depression, anxiety, nightmares, night sweat were still continuing.
Insomnia, anxiety were probably the big symptoms.
Yeah.
And when you worry with anxiety, you worry about everything. You worry about finances. You worry about other people. You worry about your mum, your dad.
Even though you really had no need to worry, because I imagine as a doctor you were, you know, had a decent income, you probably had a house by this stage, and life on the outside would have been pretty good.
Well, I think the weird thing, actually, and I've only learned this recently, is that people have layers. And so on the outside you can present reasonably good. You know, you're jovial, you're friendly.
But when the door's shut,
you look like you're getting on with life.
Yeah.
But deep down, in fact, for most of my life, there's been fear. There's been like a scared little boy. And there's been some underlying anxiety. And sometimes you can act like there's nothing wrong, and you often go through life, you mask it.
So you reached the age of 40. So what did you do about it? You are obviously a man who loves to study. You're highly intelligent. And look on the front of your book and you've got so many letters after your name. It's extraordinary. You're starting with the MBCHB and finishing with a PhD. So you're a very highly qualified man, which suggests that you have done literally years and years and years of study. How old are you now, Girish?
I'm 53.
Okay.
I've been at university 27 years after I left school.
Right.
And
after your basic medical training, you have tried to find out for personal reasons, perhaps more than anything, just what is wrong with me, but more to the point, what can I do to help others who are feeling the same as I am about anxiety and depression and suffering the side effects of that? So in the context of a radio show, can you give us a brief summary of what you have discovered?
For sure, Peter. Firstly, what happened was the main skills I looked at gaining were to learn to think and to learn to think outside the square. And I think this is one of the real problems with medicine particularly, is that we work on a certain volume of knowledge and we just work down a certain pathway of patients, whether we're a pain specialist, a neurologist, a psychologist, a cardiologist, and that narrows our vision to a certain point of, you know, tuning. And so one of the things I sought to do was to look outside the square. And so I did business degrees. I also did diplomas in information. And then at the age of 40, I was always interested in how stress amplifies pain. And It's a common thing I've seen for a dozen years as a pain specialist. So I decided to start doing some reading and experimenting, actually. And for me, the journey was, I was a pain specialist and all I could do was prescribe medicines like amitriptyline and others. And I saw people come back and I thought, they're actually no better, some of them.
You're prescribing painkillers. Once they're through the packet, they're coming back to see you.
They're coming back to see me and they say, oh, you know, the pain's still there. I'm still not able to do things. So I thought, this is not going to do it for me. Because one of the things as doctors, we want to help people. And when our toolbox is so small, we find there's a proportion of people that just won't get better. And so I started thinking outside the square. And at this time, I started doing saline injections, actually, of all things, initially, and looking
at salt and water.
Salt and water with anesthetic, and looking at muscles, and some people just got better. And there was newspaper articles on it. In fact, several people just went to zero pain. And I thought, what's going on here.
Is there any chemical reason for that?
No. In fact, I think I was just treating muscle pain, and a proportion of people have muscle pain. And that proportion was getting better. But it made me think a lot more about it. So I went and hit the books. And then I basically enrolled in a PhD at Massey University. And I'd like to have a plug for Associate Professor Rachel Page, who was my supervisor. And she.
So what was the thesis of your PhD?
It was about headache disorders. So I took headaches as an unexplained chronic pain syndrome.
Yep.
And I looked at all the aspects of headaches, including pathophysiology, how they occur, treatments, etc., and looked at and tried to make a model. So how can I explain how stress contributes to headache? And so headache could have been chronic low back pain. It could have been fibromyalgia. It could have been any headache, any sort of chronic pain syndrome, but I chose headache as
But aren't most headaches caused by dehydration, tiredness, simple reasons such as that? I mean, again, I'm talking from personal experience. If I have a headache, for some bizarre reason, I don't want to take a painkiller. I'd drink three or four glasses of water, go and have a lie down, and miraculously it seems to improve. Am I lucky?
I like it, Peter. I like it. And this is what I hear many days, in fact, almost every day. And yesterday, in fact, when I was on the project, the lady goes, oh, I get a lot of headaches and I drink 3 litres of water a day. Yeah. I said to her, look, you're actually probably doing your kidneys no favours here. And when you look at the world and the distribution of headache and migraine, it's least common in Africa.
Where it's about as dry as it is anywhere on the planet.
Where dehydration is at its maximum.
Yeah.
And it's least common in Europe, where it's coldest, where dehydration will be the least.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with dehydration, Peter.
What about tiredness?
Tiredness, yes.
Okay.
Basically, when you don't sleep, and that's probably the reason your headache gets better, is because you're lying down. And in fact, what I did discover with the stress and pain paradigm is that when you have stress, you have 6 neurotransmitters or chemicals released in your brain. They attach to your brain, different parts of your brain, and they create symptoms. So in one part of your brain, the part of your brain that feels sensations, they actually increase sensations of pain by increasing electricity. In another part of your brain, they may derail your sleep, so they wake you up. In another part of your brain, they may give you anxiety. So that's sort of the model that's come from the PhD. In the last 4.5 years, I've spent looking at the medical research on insomnia, anxiety, depression to piece together a story about how it happens and how to get rid of it.
So that's what the new book is about, Brain Connections, how to sleep better, worry less, and feel happier.
Absolutely. In fact, the early title was The Science and Solutions for Insomnia, Anxiety, and Depression.
Now, this is a fascinating topic, Girish, and I'm sure that many people would like to have the opportunity to talk to you about their problems, about their medical issues. This is not sort of doctor on the radio type of thing, but I'm sure you'd be delighted to take calls from people who may have symptoms that we've been talking about, such as anxiety, depression, and the side effects of it. So if you'd like to talk to Girish, our number is, as usual, 0800 844 747. You can text us on 3920 as well, and I'll take some texts and ask questions on your behalf if you don't wish to go on the radio. 28 minutes past 11, Dr. Girish Kanji is with us to talk about these issues. So in summary, Girish, then before we take a news break and maybe some calls that will come through, can you just briefly tell us what the solution that you've found is, if it is as simple as that, to be able to express what is the best way to relieve the pain of headaches, relieve the pain of anxiety and depression in a simple, straightforward, and perhaps non-medical, non-interventionist way?
Well, basically what I found was the stress nervous system can create these symptoms, and winding down the stress nervous system helps the symptoms. So we're talking things like yoga, tai chi, meditation, breathing, sauna, and exercise that's relatively rigorous. And if we have these habits regularly, we will certainly improve our symptoms of insomnia, anxiety, and depression. With headaches, there's a slightly different field in that the neck is often the source of pain in headache, and it refers into the head. So for headache pain, it's also useful to have the habits that reduce stress chemicals, but then you also would, it's useful to have some knowledge on neck posture and how to treat the neck.
Okay, so the idea of sitting in front of a TV, slouching on the couch, is not going to help your overall well-being.
Well, actually, Peter, it's probably going to help your well-being quite a lot.
Really?
Well, firstly, the slouching is a good posture for your back and your neck. So when you do slouch...
Even with no support under your lower back?
With the support.
Okay, that's the rider.
Yeah, placing your body weight through the back of the chair, such as reclining, is the ideal position for your spine, because all the gravity is now going through the back of the chair and it's not going through your spine itself. So pressure is one of the dominant things that aggravate spinal pain.
Wow. This is a fascinating topic, and I must tell my wife your recommendations, as she's always at me about slouching in front of the TV. Goresh Kanji, stay right there. We'll be back with you very shortly.